Welcome to Pretty Lies and Alibis. Let's seek the truth and travel the long road to justice together. What you know, alibiers, happy Sunday. Told you guys I was going to do some case updates because during the week right now, it's all George Wagner all day. And I really haven't had time to catch up on some developments. So just a really quick music fact. The song Call Me by Blondie was originally written for Stevie Nicks, but it became a number one hit for Blondie. So, all right, case updates. First off, we're going to talk about Chad Daybell's hearing from last week. It was last Thursday, and Pryor asked that Chad's trial not begin until at least October of next year. However, he said he would be ready for trial in January, but wanted more time to prepare. And he said there's discovery he still hasn't received from the state. So the state asked for a stay or pausing Chad's trial until Lori's competency is determined. And Pryor wasn't having that at all. So he said, Ms. Vallow, is allegedly mentally unfit, and the court is going to put a stay on me because potentially she has a problem. I object on that basis. Shots fired. Judge Boyce denied the stay, but he did say he has concerns postponing the trial with scheduling issues with Ada County and also the fact that Chad has been jailed for more than a year. It says, is Mr. Daybell aware of the potential very lengthy delay this may cause in the case if we reschedule this entire trial? And so Pryor said, Mr. Daybell and I have gone over every aspect of the case. He's in agreement. It would be a good idea to set this out. He's prepared and authorized me to file this motion to continue. And according to East Idaho News, Chad was nodding his head in agreement. So the state did not object to continuing the trial for Chad as long as it remains joined with Lori's. Now, we know Pryor wants this totally separated. They asked that it begin, the state asks that it begin in September 2023 so that the trial actually covers two fiscal years, which would ease the financial burden of the trial for Madison and Fremont counties. And that makes sense. So Judge Boyce didn't immediately rule on that, but said he would issue a written decision soon. Pryor says he's not received all of the discovery in the case. The state says their office has given Pryor all of the discovery and some DNA and other evidence could be given at a later time. So I'm guessing maybe they have the DNA results back, but you know, I mean, if they have it, they should probably produce it to him. Just saying, don't want any trouble. So there was a motion for the grand jury transcripts, and Pryor wanted the transcripts from that December 2021 grand jury that did not end up with an indictment. Pryor said, I received information through the investigation of this case that there may have been a grand jury proceeding. I do not have specific information as to what was offered as testimony in that proceeding. What I do have is information that would suggest potential witnesses in this case offered testimony as it relates to the case. So Rob Wood, the prosecutor, said currently there's no transcript of that proceeding, but he would have no problem in Pryor having it if one was made and also if he's allowed to legally. So the attorneys met in private in chambers, and after that meeting, Pryor was granted that request for the grand jury transcript as long as he keeps it confidential. So there was the motion for the bill of particulars also, which tells a defendant the nature of their charges and the evidence against them. The state objected, saying it explains why Chad is being charged. And Rachel Smith said this is a really creative effort on behalf of both defendants to try to get the state's theory of the case. That motion was denied. So then the motion to sever and motion to unseal records was next. This was continued actually until November 10th to give Pryor time to read the state's response, which I believe was filed the day before this hearing. Also, Lori Hellis argued her motions to unseal the documents and the transcripts that have been sealed previously in this case, and Judge Boyce said he would take that under advisement. Larry Woodcock, JJ's grandpa, gave a statement to East Idaho News after the hearing saying, whatever this turns out to be time-wise, we'll be there. We've waited 3 years, and if it's January 17th, that's fine. If it's July 17th, that's fine. We're going to be here. We intend to follow this through if the good Lord is willing. Hopefully, sooner than later, but it looks like at least September of next year, nearly a year out again. Chad's next hearing is November 10th to talk about that motion to sever. So a little update on the Cassie Carley case. So we know that Cassie was last seen exchanging custody of her daughter with her ex, Marcus Spanavello. And she was found a week later buried in a shallow grave in a barn in Alabama. And Marcus had connections with that barn. He had been doing some work in there. So last week it was announced that the autopsy results were, it could not be determined her manner or cause of death. So we were all freaking out, thinking, what's going to happen? So pretty soon after that, everybody, I mean, my heart dropped when they announced that they were dropping the charges against Marcus for what he was being held in Florida, which was giving false information concerning a missing person investigation, tampering with evidence, which he threw her cell phone out the window. And that was in Santa Rosa County in Florida. He hasn't been charged with Cassie's murder at this point, and he was set to trial next week, actually, on those charges. And I mean, everybody was just so bummed. But then somebody sent me a post that said, "We knew this was coming, y'all. It's good. Skip those tiny charges and let's get him to Alabama so we can get this murder trial started." So not too long after that, it was revealed there was a hold for St. Clair County in Alabama and a new out-of-state fugitive charges posted out of Florida with no bond. Now, the only thing he had filed was not showing for a traffic ticket in December for Alabama. But a court filing by Florida Assistant State Attorney Mark Alderman said, in an effort to prosecute the strongest case and after communicating with law enforcement agencies in both states, the Office of the State Attorney believes that in the interest of justice, the actions of Marcus Spanavello are most appropriately prosecuted in Alabama. So it says he'll be transported by law enforcement to Alabama. So a lot of people have asked, can they charge him with murder without the autopsy being able to determine a cause of manner of death? And the answer is yes, really. It's kind of like prosecuting a murder case almost without a body. So it's going to be one of those things where I think maybe a jury is going to have to use common sense that he was last seen with her. It was over custody. They had been in court for custody issues, and she's found in a shallow grave in a barn where he had been working. So I'm not super worried about this going to trial, to be honest. It's kind of one of those things where you connect the dots and you kind of get the big picture. So, all right, this is a trigger warning. This deals with really bad sexual assault. And this is Timothy Hazlitt Jr., 39 years old, from Missouri. And this has been all in the news for about a week now, and a woman escaped after being held captive for over a month at his home. And she ran from the house on October 7th to a neighbor's house, and the neighbor told the Daily Mail that she heard a very softly spoken, "Help me," and saw the woman kind of hunched over on the front steps with a metal collar around her neck that looked like a shock collar, and it had a padlock on it. She had ligature marks on her wrists and ankles, and the neighbor, who is a nurse, said the wounds were bleeding, and she said the victim looked like something out of a horror movie. This case has shook me to my core. There are some evil people out there, and it is so evident in this case just how at risk we all are, but you meet the wrong person, and it's just... She said the woman couldn't have been more than 70 pounds and she couldn't produce tears. The nurse says she thinks that's how dehydrated she was, that she couldn't even produce tears. So the woman went to call 911 and the victim said the man would kill them both. When she asked who the victim was referring to as far as the man, she said the man up the street. So after the neighbor went in and called 911, she saw the woman had left and was going to another neighbor's house. And she was probably terrified. The woman wasn't coming back or was freaked out or something. Poor thing. So she knocked on another door and the neighbor heard the woman say, "You have to help me. I've been sexually assaulted. I've been held captive. You've got to get help. He's going to end up killing me." The woman said she had barely clothed in a latex outfit. She was weak, really thin, had duct tape hanging from her neck as if her mouth had been covered and she had freed that. So this woman took her inside and gave her food and water and a blanket while they waited for police. She told the woman her friends didn't make it. He killed my friends. Now, I know on social media, and I typically don't post rumors or something that law enforcement can't confirm, but there have been people in the past few months who have brought up that a known area for prostitution in Missouri, in Kansas City, has had some women go missing or be brutalized. And the cops seemingly didn't take it super serious or said they had no proof of that. Now they're maybe going to look into this a little harder because she made clear she had some friends who he killed. He had restrained her wrists and ankles in handcuffs, and the padlock on the collar was removed when EMS arrived because it was restricting her breathing. She pointed out Timothy's house as she was being taken to the hospital, and she was able to escape when he took his young son to school, who had been living in the house the entire time this was going on. I hope to God he didn't see or hear anything. She told police she had been picked up by Timothy in early September in Kansas City, and he took her to his basement and held in a small room that he had built down there. She was sexually assaulted and frequently beaten. Cops had actually been called to that house 3 times in the past year. 2 of those were welfare checks. 1 of those was on November 23rd of last year from his dad, who lives out of state. And then the second one was on December 31st of last year from a coworker who was concerned after he didn't show up for work. The third call was from July 5th of this year about a dog who was off the leash at the home. His initial arrest was on an animal-related issue, and the neighbor who filmed his arrest initially felt bad thinking that Timothy has been arrested for the animal. And then he went to sleep and woke up and found out what had actually happened to this lady, and he just felt terrible. So the victim told police there are other victims and 2 of her friends were murdered. So they brought a cadaver dog to the property, but they haven't said publicly if anything was found. They brought a lot of stuff out from a search warrant, though, and they found multiple firearms in the house. So we don't know much about his background, but we do know that he was divorced in 2016 and had primary custody of his son. So neighbors say he was a loner and kind of strange, but nothing that would indicate he was just a monster. One neighbor said the only odd thing they noticed is that when he would keep his truck parked out on the road during the week, but every Friday he would move it to the back of his property on the driveway in front of the garage, and then he would move it back to the road Sunday night. That was kind of the only thing odd that they saw. Then he told a neighbor in 2020 that he had quit work due to heart problems, and then after that, the neighbor noticed he would get multiple deliveries a day for packages. Sometimes as many as 4 or 5. He's been charged in Clay County for rape, kidnapping, and assault, and the woman is in stable condition, and I hope to goodness she's going to get some intense psychological therapy because this is out of a horror movie, what she's been through. He has a bond hearing this Tuesday, so I'm going to watch that. I'm sure it'll be no bond. He has pled not guilty, by the way. Josh Duggar, real quick update. The prosecution has asked for an extension on the deadline to file a reply to Josh's brief in federal appeals court. They note that Josh's 3 extensions total 63 days, and the defense did not object to this request. So it's kind of nice because he's just kind of been gone and out of the news and off our tongues. Been nice just to not hear about that dude. All right, Murdaugh, this gets a little intense here. So his defense attorneys have filed a motion to compel for the state to produce all polygraph data, examiner notes, and quality control reviews related to the lie detector test given to Curtis Eddie Smith, his little co-conspirator, which was done on May 5th of this year. Eddie said in the polygraph exam, he knew nothing about the murders. He said, quote, I heard Maggie had a thing going on with the groundskeeper, which I never met him. Don't know his name. And Paul went down into one of the barns and caught him, and he got upset, went and got his rifle and was hollering and screaming. His mama was running and she fell down and she got up. He shot her in the behind and the bullet came out the top of her head, and he turned to the groundskeeper guy, but the groundskeeper already had went to his truck and got a shotgun. Doesn't really sound plausible to me, but, you know. The examiner asked Eddie, was he there that night? And he said, where was he that night? And he said, at home. He said there were people at his house until 9:15 or 9:30 that night. Anyway, a man named Steve Hudson was there. He also said some lady named Donna was at the house. And she said, we slept together and we worked on a Peterbilt truck that day and helped Kevin put in a number 4 injector. The examiner told Eddie what would be asked during the actual exam. And when asked if he shot Paul or Maggie, he said no several times. According to Murdaugh's attorney, Eddie failed that polygraph, and the notes say response indicative of attempted deception were noted in the following questions. Did you shoot either of those people at the property on Mazell Road last June? Were you present when either of those people were shot at that property on Mazell Road? So Murdaugh's attorney provided a screenshot of the surveillance taken during the exam and zoom in on a response that they say is deceptive. Murdaugh's attorney said Sled did not interview this lady named Donna Easton after the alleged failed polygraph test, but they did interview two other people named Steve Hudson and Kevin Salisbury. They said Sled waited 2 weeks to interview them, and it gave Eddie time to tell them what to say. Hudson claimed to be mowing Eddie's lawn at 9:10 p.m. using the headlights on the mower, and Kevin said he was working on a truck at Eddie's until 10 or 11, the night of the murders. He also told investigators he's known Eddie for 20 years, and Eddie called him after failing the polygraph to say that Sled may be inquiring about his whereabouts on June 7th. Eddie also told him he was worried the criminal charges he had may cause him to lose his home. So Murdaugh's lawyer says the state has given them the pre-exam interview, the polygraph exam, the post-exam interview, but the report did not have the data underlying the report or the quality assurance report. They also want all evidence seized in a search warrant on Eddie's property on September 7th of last year, cell phone records, and with the warrant affidavit stating that Eddie deleted his call logs and texts several times a day. They say they haven't received any of this from the state. They also want any notes from an interview with Donna Easton. And they also want DNA results from Eddie to compare to the crime scene in the murders of Maggie and Paul. So the filing says the state assumed Alex's guilt before reviewing any evidence. They also say that failing to produce this discovery is a Brady violation. And because of this, the court should order the motion to compel. It says that Eddie was known to deliver drugs to the dog kennel area where Maggie and Paul were found. The filing goes on to say that the forensic evidence the state collected not only is insufficient to prove that Alex shot Maggie, but it proves Alex did not shoot Paul. The state has a weak circumstantial case based entirely on Alex being at the scene within an hour or so after the time of death, and a minuscule amount of Maggie's blood on a T-shirt transferred when he frantically attended his wife's bloody corpse, which the state's own expert's opinion is that it's unlikely to be spatter resulting from being the shooter. So Fitz News broke earlier in the year that they had found microscopic blood spatter in Alex's shirt the night he was wearing the night of the murders. Now, the thing is this, to get that kind of microscopic blood spatter on your shirt, you have to be within close proximity at the time of the shooting, because it's kind of gross, but if you can imagine bashing in a watermelon with like a bat, you get all this stuff that goes everywhere. Well, when somebody is shot or hit with an object that and you're at very close range, you get these little microscopic drops like right in the threads of your shirt that they can see with a microscope. So it means you had to have been within a certain vicinity of the bodies or the person that was shot. So I don't know. I mean, it could be that this is a filing by his attorneys, and that could literally be his opinion, although he says the state agrees. or the whoever examined that shirt. They say that Eddie signed a proffer agreement on November 30th of last year, saying he agrees to be fully truthful with the Attorney General's office and its law enforcement investigators. His defense says the failing of the polygraph constitutes a breach of that agreement and renders the state's obligations null and void. Yet they say Eddie will be cooperating witness against Alex in the upcoming murder trial. Here's the thing, though. I don't know how far that'll go because polygraphs are not admissible in court. And I don't know that they're going to go back on their word with Eddie if he has a lot of goods on Alex. The state said the reason he failed is because he murdered Maggie and Paul. They say DNA has not been collected from Eddie to compare to DNA found at the crime scene. And they asked the judge for a court order allowing the defense to collect and examine the DNA of Eddie Smith. So we'll see what happens in that, but just some little nuggets in that filing. So that was kind of all as far as updating on the cases that we're following. I don't think that much is going to happen in Lori and Chad's case for a while. It's going to take a while to get her tested and get those results interpreted and then deciding what to do. Looks like there's just some housekeeping things for Chad's lawyer. And if they agree to continue the case, I expect this will go quiet for quite a while. So, yeah, so tomorrow I'll be back with another full day of testimony in the Wagner case. I'm thinking maybe we might hear Jake's interview at the border this week sometime, hopefully. And they're saying, according to one of the reporters who's in the courthouse, and the name escapes me right now, but they expect this trial to go into the first or second week of November. So we're still potentially a month away from being finished with this trial when it goes to the jury. I'm very curious to know when Jake's going to testify. If I knew for sure, I would buy a plane ticket and go out and sit for that for sure. But it's going to be very last minute, I think, very hushed. And I don't think they're going to let out when he's going to testify. But we're going in chronological order. So we are up to the point to where they've come back from Alaska and have moved back into Angela's dad's home. So I think we're starting to get close to the time of arrest. I am going to tomorrow hopefully be able to put some footage on the screen during the episode showing Billy Wagner's arrest. I haven't seen any footage for the other three, but it's, you look at Billy, he's a brute, but he seems like a big wuss, really. So anyways, it's been an interesting trial so far. Hopefully the prosecution does a good job this week and starts to drive home the fact that George knew about the murders. And I'll say right now, the biggest mistake the defense made was saying he was oblivious, when really, I think it would have been more convincing if they would have said he was threatened. His life was threatened. You see what they did to eight people. Allegedly, Angela's saying that they're going to hurt or kill her if her mom doesn't sign the custody documents. That would have been a much better defense. But hey, the cat's out of the bag. They say he didn't know nothing. So interested to see their side of the case. All right, guys, have a good rest of your Sunday. We'll see you soon.